Our 121 MPs returned from their fortnight's adjournment over the school holidays to a packed week in the House, with a snap debate on prison violence, a burst of urgency to fix a legal hole in enforcement of speed limits on the country's roads, and a night of photo finishes and votes on members' bills. With 121 MPs, votes, or divisions as they're properly called, cannot be any closer than 61-60. It's happened before, but on Wednesday, when government ministers mounted their fortnightly retreat from the chamber to let backbenchers make some progress on their members' bills, debate on four of them ended up in that bedrock division of 60-61. For Labour's Mecca Fitaly, that one-vote majority carried her members' bill that would require the Environmental Protection Authority to add protection, maintenance and enhancement of the environment to its legislated list of objectives through its first reading, thanks to the United Future member for Ahuriu, Peter Dunn. Mr Dunn then crossed back to join National and the ACT member for Epsom, David Seymour, to defeat the next three members' bills by the same margin, although New Zealand First MP, Tracy Martin, hoped Mr Seymour would take Peter Dunn's place by voting for her bill reversing the government's Sky City Casino Convention Centre deal.
At least I hope, possibly, at least one member of a very, very minority party inside this parliament may allow his initial reaction to this bill, an initial reaction to this bill to prevail, to grab hold of his gumption, don't answer that phone, get hold and come down and cast a vote to actually see this bill go through to select committee. Go with your initial reaction, I say to that member, and he knows who he is, he knows who he is.
With David Seymour and Peter Dunn voting with National to defeat the remaining two members' bills up for first readings on Wednesday, the empty slots created on the members' order paper were filled by four more bills drawn from the ballot on Thursday, all of them from Labour MPs and one coming back for a second go. That's Sue Moroney's bill extending paid parental leave to 26 weeks. It almost made it through the last parliament and stands a good chance in this one if it retains the support of Mr Dunn, giving it that magic number of 61. For the government, it wasn't such a good week. Plans to make inroads on the annual estimates debate, set down for 11 hours, fell apart on Tuesday when the government lost 2 hours to an urgent debate on prison violence, and another 2 hours to push through a bill validating speed limits under urgency. Next day, all the time in the chamber was taken up with question time, the general debate, and debate on members' bills. Then on Thursday, instead of continuing with the estimates debate, the government chose to advance two new bills through their first readings. The request on Tuesday for a snap debate on reports of violence and drug use at Serco's Mount Eden Corrections Facility came from Labour's spokesman on corrections, Calvin Davis, and was accepted by the Speaker, David Carter.
I call on Calvin Davis to move that the House take note of an urgent matter of public importance.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and let me say that the Serco Fight Club situation is an absolute debacle. It is a fiasco, it's a shambles, and it's an embarrassment, not only to this minister, but to the government. And I'm told on good authority that there is a practice in Mount Eden Correctional Facility that is called dropping, where prisoners, new prisoners usually, who are walking to the Mount Eden Correctional Facility are sized up by gangs, they're bashed up and they're dropped off the balconies onto the concrete below for good measure. That's what happened to prisoner Evans. Unfortunately, prisoner Evans passed away. So people are dying because of Serco.
Labour's Calvin Davis. And the snap debate was followed by the government taking urgency to rush through a bill validating road speed limits, as introduced by Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee.
The Land Transport Speed Limits Validation and Other Matters Bill removes uncertainty concerning the validity of speed limits and consequential enforcement actions dating back to 2004.
And while the urgency motion was not contested, Labour's transport spokesman Phil Twyford said his party would be reluctantly supporting the retrospective legislation.
Because of the potential public safety risks from motorists deliberately disregarding speed limits on the basis that they may be invalid should the issue become widely known, If urgent parliamentary action is not taken on this matter, it could take months for a road controlling authority to correct speed limit bylaws. And this would be due to the need to advertise and consult on any new bylaws using the Local Government Act 2002 consultative requirements. So there you have it. The House is between a rock and a hard place.
Labour's transport spokesman Phil Twyford as the House sped away from that hard place, passing the new speed limit law at high speed after the dinner break on Tuesday. Then it was on to the committee stage of this year's estimates debate, its start delayed by about 4 hours. Also this week, Thursday, saw questions for Housing Minister Nick Smith about the government's response to foreign property ownership from Labour's housing spokesman, Phil Twyford.
Which is the correct version of the government's position on a register of foreign property ownership? His statement that the government would release information showing how many non-residents have bought property and which jurisdiction they come from within 3 months, or Land Information Minister Louise Upston, who told the New Zealand Herald that it would not be a foreign buyer register and no decision had been taken about whether it would be publicly released.
The Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, I can assure the member that the data provided by the government will be a lot more accurate than the dodgy Chinese targeted attack that he did on one group of ethnic New Zealanders that most members of this House found abhorrent. Mr. Speaker, in respect of the data that will be collected with the bill that the government announced, the details of that are in the legislation. It is not a foreign buyer register. It is a tax record for non-residence taxpayers.
Housing Minister Nick Smith. And the legislation setting up that tax record was the subject of submissions to the Finance and Expenditure Committee the previous day. Making a submission on the Taxation, Land Information and Offshore Persons Information Bill's requirement for overseas buyers to open a bank account and get an IRD number, Ernst & Young's Executive Director, David Snell, recommended a bolder approach.
Why have the offshore person definition at all? Instead, have all parties to purchases and sales of properties providing their IRD numbers. We think it would be much easier for people to provide a known number rather than make potentially complex judgments in a specialist area around tax residence around the compliance or not with an offshore person's definition.
And Mr. Snell had another suggestion.
We also thought, if you're currently subject to tax overseas, then just provide your overseas tax information number, your equivalent of an IRD number, as a matter of course. That will give a stronger information base, a clearer signal for taxpayers.
Following on from Ernst & Young's David Snell, Chapman Tripp partner David Patterson spotted a potential flaw in compiling the register of foreign buyers.
The perspective that I would bring to that would be to say, well, actually, if I've got someone who is a foreigner within whatever definition you want to set up, and that could be a tax one or an offshore one, but they are coming in and they're genuinely buying their own main home, I would actually wonder whether they'd need to be reported, because they're actually the sort of person that is a foreigner who's become a resident. We're going to count them as a foreigner. Now, we don't have an exemption for that person, so we will be counting them, and presumably someone will be adding up the numbers and may well be reporting someone who's come in, and they may still be tax resident in another country as a foreigner, even though they are actually here, have purchased a main home and have intended to come and live here.
Chapman Tripp's David Patterson speaking to the Finance and Expenditure Committee on Wednesday, when in the room next door the Social Services Committee met for a briefing from the Auditor General's Office on its report on the first 4 years of whānau order. Making the presentation to the committee was the Auditor General's Manager of Performance Audits, Evan Aramakutu, who outlined some difficulties raised in the report.
First of all, it seemed like almost everybody we spoke to about whānau order had a different view about what whānau order was and what it was trying to achieve. And we think that impacted on how effective they thought whānau order was being. Point to make here is that we couldn't get a consistent explanation from the joint agencies about what whānau order was and what it was trying to achieve. And we think that contributed to some of the confusion that there's undoubtedly about whānau order.
Mr. Aramakutu said there were lessons to be learnt.
And the first is, when you've got an innovative program, we think it's really important to be very clear and very consistent about what it is and what its aims are. And I guess a simple way of putting it is, it's very difficult to support something if you don't fully understand what it's about.
Auditor General's Office Manager of Performance Audits, Evan Aramakutu, speaking to the Social Services Committee. And on Thursday, the Justice and Electoral Committee heard calls for automatic voter registration in order to improve election participation rates. That suggestion came as the committee began its hearing of evidence to its inquiry into the 2014 election, with the idea put forward by Professor Jack Vowles, a sophologist from Victoria University, who recommended an investigation into the possibility of automatic voter registration and its adoption if it is feasible. That call from Professor Vowles came after the Electoral Commission's Electoral Policy Manager, Christina Temmill, outlined to the committee the country's declining enrolment rates.
We note that the number of people not enrolled as a percentage of the total estimated eligible population has been rising significantly over the last three elections and is now 7.4% of voting age people, which is over 250,000 people.
Christina Temmill said voting participation rates should be top of mind for all electoral policy consideration.
But it goes wider and deeper than just changing the Electoral Act, and for that reason the Commission believes that participation needs to become a whole-of-government priority with multi-party support.
The Electoral Commission's Christina Temmill speaking to the Justice and Electoral Committee. Also this week, the Chairman of the Health Committee, National Simon O'Connor, issued a statement saying an inquiry into voluntary euthanasia is to be carried out in response to a petition from former Labour MP Marion Street. And also out of the committees this week, the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee reported back on the Health and Safety Reform Bill. Back now to the Chamber, where on Thursday, Rafael González Montero was appointed Deputy Clerk for a term of 7 years, and Labour's Grant Robertson moved a motion without debate, marking the 150th anniversary of Wellington as the capital city. And for more on that, we spoke with parliamentary historian John Martin, who explained that the decision to move the capital to Wellington was not without controversy.
Yeah, well, it finally happened in 1865, and that occurred after about a decade of debate. It was one of the most politically controversial and most debated issues before Parliament in that first decade of its existence, since 1854, when Parliament first met in Auckland. And Parliament's location was not necessarily fixed permanently in Auckland, and Wellington saw its chance, if you like, to grab Parliament and the seat of government and advance the prospects of the town in the process. So its MPs went to Auckland and would always raise the issue, and other centres also had an interest. The MPs from the far south found it very difficult to get to Auckland, and it took an extraordinary amount of time. The first session of 1854 took Otago MPs 2 months to get to Auckland, and they were not keen to do that too often. So there were those sorts of issues there, and it was an issue which really plagued Parliament over those first years and was not resolved other than by some sort of temporary compromise, so that ultimately the governor would agree that there should be alternating sessions between Auckland and Wellington. And that was somewhat confused by the wars which erupted in the early 1860s in New Zealand, which basically meant that Auckland remained the seat of government because that was closer to the actual military activities. Anyway, Wellington did get one session in 1862, but that was fraught with difficulties too, because on the way down to Wellington, the ship which was carrying the cabinet and the prime minister and lots of official papers got wrecked on the coast. So this made people think hard about travelling around the country to other centres to hold parliamentary sessions. Anyway, in the end, in 1863, with a government which was dominated by Southern MPs, a resolution was agreed to amid a very fractious debate to put the decision in the hands of Australian commissioners, not to leave it to the New Zealand MPs themselves to decide, which basically they couldn't. So some Australians came over to New Zealand in 1864 and toured around the central parts of the country, the southern part of the North Island and the top of the South Island, and came to what was really a pretty obvious decision that Wellington was really the only location that made sense in that particular area, so they recommended Wellington. And so the decision was on that basis made, and the following year in 1865 the whole shebang came down to Wellington and moved into purpose-built buildings, which the Provincial Council of Wellington had some years earlier consciously built to attract Parliament down here. So from 26th of July 1865, Parliament commenced its permanent presence in Wellington itself.
And what was the procedure for, you know, was there an Act of Parliament having to pass to move the Parliament?
No, there was nothing of that nature. It was just simply a resolution carried in the House, a very controversial resolution. Auckland MPs actually walked out during the debate and were locked out because they didn't get back before the division bells finished ringing for the actual vote. So it was a very peculiar sort of vote, but it was a resolution that was carried in Parliament, and that was to set up this commission and to focus on the central parts of New Zealand in the vicinity of Wellington, and for the commissioners to make that decision. So it was simply a resolution followed by the decision of the Australian commissioners, and then about £50,000 was committed for the move itself, to buy the buildings and the land and undertake the move of people and papers and library books, etc. And so it all got underway. There was no legislation associated with it in that sense.
And obviously the buildings have changed, but is it the same location?
Yes, it's the same location. The original buildings, which the Provincial Council had built in 1858 in preparation for this eventuality, were on the site of the current Parliamentary Library. It was when that library was built in the late 1890s that the original wooden structure of 1858 was demolished, so that those buildings remained there right through most of the 19th century, from 1858 onwards, and were used by Parliament when it moved down here. And immediately they did move down, those buildings did have to be extended, and you got the big wooden complex which developed on that site, which was it was destroyed in the fire of 1907. But until that time, the historical buildings, and with the addition of the new library, were on that very site, now occupied by the Parliamentary Library.
And originally, before Parliament was in Auckland, it was a bit further north?
Well, not Parliament itself. The seat of government for a year or so was in the Bay of Islands, on Okeato, I think it was, just opposite Opua in the Bay of Islands. And then it moved pretty shortly afterwards, in 1840, down to Auckland. So the seat of government moved from the Bay of Islands to Auckland in 1840, but parliamentary government wasn't instituted until 1854. So that was, prior to that period, it was essentially government through the governor and various appointed officials that formed a kind of government department under his control. So we had that intervening period between 1840 and 1854, in which there was no representative and parliamentary form of government. No one voted until the very first elections of 1853 to elect those first MPs who went to Auckland in 1854.
Parliamentary historian John Martin, and the 150th anniversary of the capital city is being marked by the Festival of Parliament, running from the 27th of July to the 5th of August, with events taking place in Bowen House, the Beehive and the Parliamentary Library. More details on Parliament's website, parliament.nz. And also last week, there was an ongoing stoush between Labour's Grant Robertson and Finance Minister Bill English, who faced questions on the economy from his Labour shadow on each sitting day, beginning with this on Tuesday.
Does he agree with the Prime Minister that bad news about the New Zealand economy is overblown, and that while dairy prices are down, 95% of our economy is not involved in that?
The Honourable Bill English.
Speaker, yes.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker.
Supplementary question, Grant Robertson.
How does he reconcile his support for the Prime Minister's statement with the following statement also made by the Prime Minister? Quote, when things are going well on our farms, this flows through into the small towns, the provincial cities, and ultimately into our big cities. Conversely, when the primary sector sneezes, the New Zealand economy catches a cold.
Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr. Speaker, with pretty easily, actually, there's no doubt that significantly lower dairy prices for longer than expected will have some dampening effect on the economy. But unfortunately for the member, he who gives the impression that the dairy industry is about half of the New Zealand economy, he should listen to the Prime Minister, who points out that it is around 5% of GDP.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker.
Supplementary question, Grant Robertson.
Does he agree with former National Agriculture Minister David Carter, who said, quote, South Africa has diamonds, Australia has minerals, Saudi Arabia has oil, and in New Zealand we have farms based on pasture? And if so, how does that fit with 95% of the New Zealanders not being affected by plummeting dairy prices?
The Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr. Speaker, of course I agree with the former National Party Agriculture Minister. He's very well informed, very well travelled, and has great insight into the world economy. But Mr. Speaker, even that former member will be aware of the facts, which are that the dairy industry is around. Former Minister, is around 5% of GDP. And eventually, the finance spokesman for the Labour Party will avail himself of the fact.
Then there was this from Grattan Robertson to Bill English on Wednesday.
When did he first become aware that there was an international glut of dairy products? And does he stand by his reported comments that he has no plans to take active steps to diversify the economy in response to falling dairy prices?
The Honourable Bill English.
Mr. Speaker, probably with respect to the first question, around the same time as everyone else, one of the clear signals of expanded supply in the global dairy market was when prices started dropping in the GDT. With respect to diversifying the economy, I would say that, first of all, under the excellent leadership of the Honourable Stephen Joyce, the government's program through the business growth agenda is encouraging a range of industries to develop in New Zealand. And secondly, right now, I'd say the relative price signals for the dairy industry with respect to any other investment in New Zealand are probably doing a pretty good job of diversifying the economy.
Supplementary question, Mr.
Supplementary
Speaker.
Question, Grant Robertson.
Did he miss the Goldman Sachs report in July last year that said there was going to be a 5-year international dairy glut? Or like his colleague, the Minister for Economic Development, did he just think that was a laughing matter at the time?
The Honourable Bill English.
Mr. Speaker, I'd be surprised if I hadn't read that particular piece of commentary. But, of course, there's always a range of opinions in the market. And recent experience with the dairy price has been that almost all of that opinion has underestimated the extent of excess supply and therefore the short-term drop in the prices. But unlike the member, we have a positive outlook for the dairy industry in the future. Unlike the Labor Party, we don't believe New Zealand has far too much dairy and that the industry ought to shrink, which appears to be what that member thinks.
Question, Mr. Speaker.
Supplementary question, Grant Robertson.
Is he aware that dairy at 20% of New Zealand's exports represents the same percentage of exports as iron ore is for Australia? And given what has happened to the Australian economy, doesn't he think he should just be a little bit more energised in his response to the collapse in dairy prices?
Very energised.
The Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the fact is that if the dairy industry is 20% of exports, and actually it's a bit less than that, it's because it's been a successful, globally competitive industry. It would be a bit like saying, why doesn't New Zealand diversify from rugby? Because the All Blacks are too successful. We've got all our eggs in the All Black basket. The fact is, if it's a good-performing industry, then we would hope that it would keep performing. And if you think that if you think we that having too much dairy is a problem, look what happens when you have a bit too little.
Would you question, Mr. Speaker?
Order. Grant. Order. Grant. Grant Robertson, supplementary question.
Does he, therefore, in light of that answer, does he believe that today's forecast from the BNZ of a payout of $3.80 per kilo for 2015-16 and a downside scenario payment of $2.80 per kilo represents a serious problem for the health of the New Zealand economy, or is it like John Key said on Monday and it doesn't really affect 95% of people?
The Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr. Speaker, of course it's of concern, but this is an industry with, which has characteristics the member wouldn't be familiar with because he's always worked in the public sector, and that is it has developed the resilience, it has developed the resilience and the flexibility to deal with commodity cycles. And unlike that member, we have confidence that the industry will deal with the cash flow problems, quite serious cash flow problems, that flow from these very low dairy prices. In any case, the lower exchange rate will cushion the effect of the dairy on the dairy industry, but also encourage the expansion of tourism, in particular, international education, underpin the profitability of meat and wool, horticulture, the film industry, all industries which are succeeding reasonably well at the moment.
And finally, on Thursday...
Does he agree with the Reserve Bank Governor's statement that, quote, the growth outlook is now softer than at the time of the June statement, rebuild activity in Canterbury appears to have peaked, and the world price for New Zealand's dairy exports has fallen sharply?
The Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr. Speaker, generally, although not with exactly every word that the Reserve Bank Governor says, but also agree with what the Governor said when he said that the economy is currently growing at an annual rate of around 2.5%, stronger than the OECD average of 2%. So although expectations of growth may be coming back a bit from recent forecasts, we are on track for moderate, sustainable growth, as the government has been saying pretty much all year.
Supplementary question, Grant Robertson.
Is Westpac's analysis correct that the Canterbury rebuild has already peaked and won't add materially to economic growth over the remainder of this year or the next, and from 2017 will reduce economic growth by almost 0.2%?
The Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I haven't seen any of the detail of that analysis. There's been a lot of forecasts that the Christchurch activity has peaked, and it just keeps on peaking. So, for instance, while the residential rebuild is well through, the public sector rebuild, which is quite substantial, is only about 10 or 15% complete, and there are still billions of dollars to spend. So I think we've yet to see whether Christchurch activity has peaked.
Supplementary question, Grant Robertson.
Is ANZ senior economist Sharon Zollner correct when she says, quote, commodity woes are far from specific to dairy. It is a sea of red across the entire commodity complex.
Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr. Speaker... To quote my colleague, she may well be wrong on that. In fact, well, the member likes to quote bank economists when he thinks they're negative, and he won't quote them when he thinks they're positive. And actually, with respect to prices for exports, some export prices are down, some are certainly up.
Finance Minister Bill English. I'm Rhys Lyon reporting for parliamenttoday.co.nz with funding from Parliament.